coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. You think streaming is old hat? It's just about putting your audio on the internet. There's actually a lot more to it than that. And the guys at Stream Guys, plus David Bialik, a streaming consultant, are here to discuss what's new and what you should be taking advantage of. It's all coming up next on TWiRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, back in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee, where we are undergoing what's left of Hurricane Ida. It has been raining and raining and raining. We had flash flood watches and warnings all over the place. Hopefully nobody is in bad shape, but going to pick my son up at school today, ugh, what a mess, man. There was water everywhere. And what is it? Not a drink to spare? No, not a drop to drink. I always forget how that goes. All right, let's not worry about what I forgot or remembered. Let's bring in some guests. We have guests with us today to talk about streaming. And streaming is, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of an old topic. It's been around for a while. On the other hand, it keeps evolving and evolving and evolving. And we keep finding ways to serve listeners, those consumers, better and better. So let's go ahead and bring them all in. We have with us some fellows from Stream Guys to talk about the technologies and the techniques that we are using in streaming. So, guys, before we get really into the meat and potatoes of the show, let's just say hi and introduce you. Right below me in this Brady Bunch panel is Eduardo Martinez. Hey, Eduardo, good to see you.
Hey, Kirk. Great to see you. My name is Eduardo Martinez. I'm the director of technology for Stream Guys. I've been with the company for the past 15 years.
Oh, wow. So you know where everything is there around the office, don't you?
Indeed.
Good deal. Hey, what is the flag, the yellow, blue, red flag behind you?
That's where I'm from. That's the Venezuelan flag. I grew up in Venezuela in South America. So that's just a reminder of home there every day.
You know, most of my Venezuelan friends live, of course, near Miami. That's where most of that. And they live in towns like West Venezuela. That's what they call it. Yeah. You may know where that is on the north side of Miami.
I have a couple of friends out in Miami. So certainly a large population of expats there for sure.
But you come to us, what, from the West Coast, don't you?
I do. The sunny West Coast here in sunny San Diego.
Wow. Good deal. Good deal. Good to have you with us. Robert Minix is here. Robert, hey, good. Wow. What a beard. You both have beards. Is that a requirement to work at Stream Guys?
It's not a requirement, but it's definitely part of the uniform many of us carry around. That's us.
It looks like David and I are going to have to, you know, go talk to HR. Something. Robert, I interrupted. Tell me what you do at Stream Guys.
My name is Robert Minix. I'm the product manager at Stream Guys, so I help head up our product initiatives, manage our roadmap, and help manage our development team, make sure everything is going smoothly and that our clients are getting what they need.
And then there's the clean-shaven David Bialik. David, welcome in. Good to see you.
Good seeing you, Kirk.
David, you are a consultant not only to Stream Guys, but you've been a consultant to a lot of people on the topic of streaming. Talk to me about your relationship with Stream Guys and how you kind of help bring them technology needs or ideas.
Well, I'm the former director of streaming operations for both CBS Radio and Entercom, mm-hmm. and I also consult to many other radio stations and groups that are streaming now, and I'm now consulting with Stream Guys and helping other streamers use their products.
Good deal. Good deal. Well, David, it's good to see you. And I know you, Stream Guys, by consulting with you, they're talking to the right guy about streaming since you've done so much of this. Hey, guys, we're going to jump into the show here in just a minute. I want to tell our listeners and viewers about Nautel and what they are doing. So I'm going to go full screen here for just a second, and we're going to pop a couple things up on the screen. Right now at Nautel, only for, I think, until the end of October. So you only have a couple of months to take advantage of this. If you're planning any kind of a new FM transmitter, especially one of the higher power, talk to your Nautel rep about the GV series of transmitters. Why? Because they've got a promotion right now where you get a free backup exciter. You buy a GV series transmitter from Nautel, and you get a free backup exciter. It's redundant. It is integrated into the GV transmitter. And you know, if you need to do any work or plugs in and out on one exciter, you've got the other exciter to go to. You need to check levels. You can even use it. Well, there's other ways to change frequencies too, but the second exciter option is a popular option. And right now, until the end of October, it is free. So talk to your rep at Nautel. You can go to Nautel.com/offers. Nautel.com/offers to read more about it. Best give your Nautel rep a call or send him or her an email and find out more about it. The other thing that Nautel is still doing, and that is the Transmission Talk Tuesday roundtable discussions. Now, these are not your usual webinars. The host, Jeff Welton, introduces a topic and opens the floor for your input and questions. Jeff has special guests almost every week. They've got Transmission Talk Tuesdays coming up most Tuesdays in September and October. Now, the best way for you to get involved with this is just to remind yourself of it. Just go to the website, nautel.com/webinars. Nautel.com/webinars. Click on the Transmission Talk Tuesdays link and just sign up. It's easy to do. Once you fill out the form the first time, probably your browser will autofill it the next time and the next time. So it's real easy to sign up. They don't bother you. They do send you a couple of emails, one email a day in advance to remind you, hey, tomorrow we got a Transmission Talk Tuesday. And then about an hour before the Transmission Talk Tuesday roundtable starts, you can be reminded once again. So I've, believe me, it's been great to have that email from Nautel. Other than that, don't expect any spam emails from Nautel. They really treat you, your privacy, with respect. So check it out, nautel.com/webinars. All right, let's jump back in here with Eduardo. Ed, if I may, right?
Yeah, and, most definitely.
And Robert Mannix, keep on to call you Mannix. You know, I grew up in the 70s with a TV show, Mannix. Did you ever see that, Robert?
I actually have. Yeah. Funnily enough, I think back in the day, I don't remember how many generations back, we used to be Mannix and then got switched to Mannix because we wanted to differentiate ourselves, I guess. I don't remember his reasoning at the time, but it's funnily enough when that comes up.
All righty. Now, so in the course of our conversation here, we're going to talk about, you know, different technologies. I'm running the show here today. I'm doing the camera switching. I ain't too good at that. So, you know, if you're not on camera and you got something to say, your mic is open. So just go right ahead and say it, please. Let's begin by talking a little bit about, tell you what, let's set a little bit of a stage. We're going to talk about how streaming has changed and is changing, and what broadcasters or other webcasters need to be thinking about for the future. What services, what features are available that actually make their listeners happy, and things that are useful. And I know some of the things you guys do are things that, I appreciate it when they're there. You know, when a station is using your guys' company, Stream Guys, to do the streaming, I know there's some extra features there. So why don't we start with a little bit of history? And Ed, you've been around the longest around Stream Guys anyway. Talk to us about kind of where streaming was in the early days when you were there.
Yeah, most definitely. Since the company's been around since 2000, you know, I've been there for a good portion of it. Streaming, you know, has come such a long way from the very early days of just, you know, a 24 kilobit per second stream, you know, unreliable when everybody was still kind of using pretty rudimentary modems and things like that. That, you know, the evolution of streaming has really taken quite the turn to where now, you know, you have a complete personalized experience. As you know, we believe that the end user is always kind of in the driving seat more and more these days in terms of how they're consuming streaming. So at the end of the day, you know, it's up to the broadcasters to curtail to the end user and provide those experiences that differentiate themselves from the beginning of, you know, back in the day of early streaming. So things like being able to, you know, access, you know, programs at any time of day, whether it's, you know, an archive from an air check, being able to rewind streams, there, you know, it really kind of puts that end user back in the driver's seat when you're consuming streaming media there.
Let me, anyone of you can answer, but David Bialik has also been around streaming for a long time. Why were we streaming at ridiculously low bit rates when streaming got started 15, 20 years ago or so? I think I know the answer, but talk to me about that. Cause man, when I had lunch with Frank Foti one day, before I was an employee at Telus, and I said, Frank, you heard of the streaming thing, right? Like real audio? And Frank said, yeah. I said, it sounds like crap, doesn't it? He said, yeah, yeah, it sounds terrible. I said, could you do any processing to make that sound better? And Frank said, that's a good idea. I'm going to look into that. And so Frank did develop some things that made it sound better. But let me get back to the question. Why were we streaming at such ridiculously low bit rates when streaming got started?
Well, first off, there was a small bandwidth pipe because bandwidth costs a lot of money. And also, the people listening, your audience, at a lot were listening on phones and paying for the amount of bytes being received. So you wanted low bandwidth, low bit streaming. So your listener wouldn't be incurring a fee, because if you incurred a fee, hey, they weren't going to listen, or they weren't going to listen as long. So that was the whole thing about that.
I remember, man, how long has it been? It's been 20 years ago. I built a radio station in American Samoa. And when we moved from the transmitter site, because we started out with the automation at the transmitter site, moved to a studio, we got internet. And I didn't have a router. We didn't need a router. We had like 3 public IP addresses. Boy, what a mistake that was. And I thought, I want to listen to something. And so I found that WLW in Cincinnati was streaming Cincinnati Reds baseball games. And I kind of grew up around there, so I thought, this will be interesting. So while I'm punching down wires in the studio, I'm listening to the Cincinnati Reds in freaking American Samoa. And I thought, man, this streaming is kind of a cool thing. Ed, back to you for a second. Tell me more about your early days. What did streaming look like in terms of bit rate, and were there multiple bit rates, and how did it fit together 15 years ago?
Sure, most definitely. You know, 15 years ago, it was fairly rudimentary in terms of, you know, broadcasters, you know, were able to get their streams on the internet. It was usually at a very super low bit rate. Traditionally, you know, it was MP3 was the codec of choice back then. You know, a lot of the signals, you know, being processed those days on air really didn't have specific digital signal processing for streaming. So we've seen that evolution. You know, when people want that radio sound, that signature radio sound, that you see broadcasters really heavily investing in digital signal processing. Back in the day, it was just a lot more rudimentary. It's kind of the Wild West of, you know, low bit rate, kind of antiquated technologies. You know, from a resilience perspective on the client side, you know, it's fairly different. If you're a bandwidth constraint, you know, you'd have a lot of issues with buffering. These days, you know, the evolution of that, it's just a brand new world where broadcasters are really caring about, you know, the way that they sound on the internet and processing differently for the internet than they are for a terrestrial broadcast. You know, in addition, you know, there the technology's grown so much from a delivery perspective, where you have technologies like HLS that greatly significantly improve the reliability of the client experience when you're streaming.
I'm going to ask you about HLS a little bit later in the show. That's a great topic. I want to know where that's standing. And let me hit Robert up with a question real quick before we take our first break. Robert, indeed, bit rates were low, but let me ask about mistakes that broadcasters made early on compared to streaming mistakes they make now. And, you know, back early on, yeah, they would take a feed off a radio that was picking them up off the air and feed that into some kind of streaming encoder or a computer. Mm-hmm. And they may have gone into tap a speaker and go into a line level input on the back of the computer. And it was just horrible in so many ways. And yet there's streams on the internet that I think are still just about as bad. Robert, for you, what's the biggest mistake broadcasters used to make, and what are they still making mistakes with today in terms of audio?
I mean, I think you really didn't hit the nail on the head with what life used to be like. I mean, nowadays, or even back then, but nowadays there are so many streaming broadcasters, whether they're pure play broadcasters or actual terrestrial stations that are trying to get into streaming, who don't make a separate feed. They're just taking whatever they're sending out to the transmitter, and they're just piping that same thing into their streaming encoders, which for the most part these days is effectively the same thing as what you described in terms of having a radio plugged into the back of some computer or an encoder, just directly piping out whatever they're actually listening to. That's I never want to see that again, but I'm sure I will see it many times when we get people coming to us. Sometimes in the R&D land that Ed and I live in, that's very much a reality for some of the things we see when we're trying to do some quick and dirty testing. That's for sure. I don't really see too many real problems these days. I think the biggest issues are just that engineers that have been working in hardware, in terrestrial radio for 20, 30, 40 years are trying to learn what streaming really is. And the biggest problems are just in that learning curve and trying to figure out that technology. Outside of that, once people get going, streaming is as simple as it can be and or as complicated as you want it to be. So
we've got a lot more to talk about, including the ability to, cast to multiple places, multiple bit rates, to rewind something you've been listening to. Hey, I missed that. I'd love to hear it. Oh, it's a stream. I can't listen it back to it. You guys have got some solution to that. And then this idea of allowing only maybe people who are subscribers to listen to maybe a particular version of something, maybe a commercial free version or an extended version of some content that you're producing. Hey, we'll put the basic thing out there for free, maybe, or maybe we'll put the first four innings out there for free, but you want the rest of the ball game. So anyway, we're going to talk about those kind of things coming up in just a minute. It's This Week in Radio Tech, our 560th episode. And I'm very pleased to have some guys with us from Stream Guys, and David Bialik is here with us as well, talking about streaming. We're going to be right back here in just a minute after this word from our friends at Broadcast Bionics and Camera One. Hang on.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics. Designed to bring video to your audio content. Visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot, and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's Red Lights Fire IP or an Avantek Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good-spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
You know, it's a commercial like that and product like that that reminds us that broadcasting is changing. And you need to change along with it. It's part of our topic today. But Camera One from Broadcast Bionics at bionic.radio. That's the website you want to go to, bionic.radio, to check that out. Hey, it's This Week in Radio Tech, episode 560. And I've got a whole crew here with me. Below me in the screen here is Eduardo, or Ed Martinez. Also, this way here. There's Robert Minix. They're both from Stream Guys. And man. I got to get better graphics. My graphic guy is out. There's David Bialik down there. He's a consultant to Stream Guys and to broadcasters all over the world on the topic of streaming, and did a lot of work with Intercom and CBS Radio to get them all set up. Okay, so I'm not sure what to. Oh yeah. Let's jump into a couple of the things that you guys are doing to help solve problems. And I'm really interested in Recast first, SG Recast. Mm-hmm. What's the technology involved here? Who wants to handle that, Ed or Robert? What do you want?
I'll take it away.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I've had my head so deep into Eschewy Cats for the last 6 years that there's no way I couldn't be the one to talk about it.
I guess it's just what problem are we trying to solve with
so Eschewy Cast was traditionally built as a automated or a somewhat automated solution for a broadcaster to take their existing linear streams, automatically archive and then podcast that content for their audience. Over time, it has evolved quite a lot. SGRecast has become truly our premier platform for all of the various things that we want to provide broadcasters in a single platform. In terms of workflows and the techniques that we use, SGRecast is first and foremost a way for broadcasters to either reuse their existing content that they're already producing, or to automate a lot of the work that they might have to do manually elsewise that either an organization just does not have the time to do, or they don't have the knowledge to do well, and that we can leverage some very simple things from them to give them what they want at a much quicker turnaround than they could do themselves.
So, Robert, I'm part owner of some radio stations. Mm-hmm. I guess a couple of my stations have active morning shows. Occasionally we have interesting guests. Sometimes we have winners of contests, but the rest of the day, I would say my stations are not broadcasting things that are worth keeping around. They're all mm-hmm. pretty much ephemeral. If you like the latest Taylor Swift song, listen for another 90 minutes. You're going to hear it again. So I take it you're talking about content that broadcasters produce, and my stations produce a little bit of it, but other people produce it all day long. And mm-hmm. you know, plenty of public broadcasters, certainly, and there are commercial broadcasters that produce stuff that you want to hear this again, because it's mm-hmm. not DJ Bob introducing, you know, the latest Garth Brooks. Well, he's not recording anymore, but you get the idea. So what kind of broadcaster, what kind of formats, what kind of things are typical that they want to say, don't let that be just ephemeral. Let's keep that and make it easily available to people.
Yeah. So most of the time we're talking about news and talk stations, people that have, you know, the morning drive shows, the drive home shows, their midday, various forms of entertainment, whether that's, you know, hosted by various people or you have a singleton person that speaks to the void hoping to be listened to. But generally what our clients are trying to do is take those personality focused streams, fill those gaps that you're talking about. Maybe they only have 2 hours a day of premium rewatchable, sometimes re-listenable content generally, that they want people to still have access to, and that if they weren't there live for it, they want to be able to get people access to it. They can do that by recording it, and our system can record their stream directly, and then make it available in an on-demand format, as podcasting tends to be, or really just broadcast it back out in a loop on a what we call a side channel that people can tune into at any time of day and, you know, jump in as if it were a live show and just listen through until the next show comes out live and replaces that same loop. We have a number of people that do that. For the most part, though, it's for archival. You know, maybe you get 2 weeks of your shows kept, and then after 2 weeks they're gone forever, and so it helps people, you know, I missed it, I still have a chance to go watch it, but it's not going to exist in perpetuity because maybe that talk segment wasn't super important 6 months ago, but for 2 weeks it might still be relevant, and for many broadcasters that's what they're hoping for.
You know, I hadn't thought about that looping thing. Where did that idea come from? And I can see that being pretty valuable. So yeah, let's say I produce a local talk show that's 3 hours long. You mean I can have a separate channel where the latest mm-hmm. one just loops over and over and over again?
Yep. We call it record and rebroadcast. Mm-hmm. That is the workflow we have for people. Basically, if you know you have a show 6 to 8 every day, you can record that 6 to 8 time period. And then from 8 to 6 the next day, just shoot it back out on a separate side channel, whether that's a, you know, Icecast or HLS, whatever your delivery happens to be, we can make it happen. And then people can, you know, if they go to your website or open up your app and they can see your main stream, but they can also go, oh, there's a separate stream that's just the AM drive, you know, on loop. Maybe I missed it and want to pop back in, or maybe my morning drive is 9 a.m. instead of 6 a.m., right? They can still go in and they can listen live, especially if you're driving or something like that, right?
Or maybe I work third shift, but I sure like mm-hmm. the afternoon DJ and the
absolutely.
Funny game they play every afternoon.
Yeah, and then there's always just a live format to listen to. That's especially important these days with smart speakers, when people just want to listen in. If they know exactly what they want to pull up via Alexa or Google or whatever they're dealing with these days, it's easy enough to get right into it and not have to worry about, you know, figuring out if you can get her or Google, whatever you want to refer to Google as these days, to respond appropriately and figure out what podcast you want to listen to or anything like that. Nope, just go right to a live stream and you got yourself right in the middle of a show or the start of a show, wherever you happen to find yourself. But it's very popular.
By the way, whoever at Amazon named it an Echo sure missed an opportunity, because it should have been called the Speaker of the House. Mine's right back over there. And then now that you mentioned 2 weeks as being an archive period, if a station has does a show it's really special, is it possible to keep it longer or maybe even in near perpetuity?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it can be configured. Either things automatically have a certain period and you can go in and change it right once you got your recording, or you can have nothing and just go in and set them yourselves after. But I think 2 weeks is very common, especially in stations that have music mixed in with their shows. So even if they have a news or talk segment that's 2 or 3 hours in the morning, that might be intermixed with a little bit of music, and they don't want to have to keep that around for too long and worry about things like royalties and etc. Get them deleted after 2 weeks. But gotcha. For the most part, people who are doing true podcasting, I'd call it, where they're taking a show that they know is special and they want people to have access to forever, that they just broadcast live for convenience and keep the recording as an archive. We have people that have many years worth of those archives sitting around at this point.
I just thought of a use for the loop. Boy, when I was in my early 20s, I worked at an AM station, and the owner was really big with his church and their Friday fish fries. It was a big fundraiser. And I'm thinking, we should just have the fish, because he told me, I want you to mention this after every single song. I want to get everybody in town to go to the fish fry. Let's just put that on a loop channel, Bill.
Yeah,
you can tune in anytime you want.
Just turn the volume up, turn it back down.
Now I want to ask you about the technology of this, whoever wants to jump in. Of course, I could see this easily being done on a purely time period. You set up, okay, I want to do from, you know, 6A to 9A. Is there any other signaling available, or is it purely based on time?
Oh, it was definitely more available. Oh. They're the two main ways that we have people interact with the system, and that people generally have the ability to actually provide. That's the important part these days as people get more into streaming. Our time, like you mentioned, scheduling, but also metadata. So especially as broadcasters expand their streaming footprint, invest more time and resources into making sure that what they're sending is well formatted, has good metadata, so that different platforms can consume that and make it more easy for your end listeners to know what's going on, or more easy for systems like ours to target and do stuff. That metadata can actually be very important in automating workflows that let us, you know, see when your show starts, see when it ends, automatically take everything in between that happened and turn it into a podcast. And if there happens to be stuff in between that you don't want, we can get that out too and replace it with nothing or ad breaks or whatever sees fit in that output that you want for your archive. And so metadata is very big these days in terms of powerful workflows, but scheduling is certainly still there.
So metadata, tell me about how metadata would get added at exactly the right time to tell your system, I want you to start right here, and then later on, I want you to end right here. And maybe there are several start ends, you know, throughout a show. Like if I didn't want to repeat the top of the hour news or even the weather forecast, because by golly, it's going to be wrong in 3 hours.
Yeah.
How does this metadata get inserted into what you guys need to detect?
Sure. The most common way is for the station's automation system, whatever they're using to play out their content and their segments, that feeds into their streaming encoder, to be the point of contact that communicates with the encoder anytime you switch between segments or tracks or whatever it might be. And it sends off that signal to your encoder, hey, this is what I'm now playing, or this is the segment that we're going to based on your clock that you're running through the station. And then the encoder passes that along with the stream to us, and we can, as we're listening to the stream in our platform in the cloud, can see that metadata, respond to that metadata, and for the most part, some stations a lot more careful about it, some other stations not so careful about it. The timing of that, since it's as your automation system is transitioning from one piece of content to another, as it's feeding that audio to your encoder, as it gets that message, hey, this is what I'm playing now, and now it's encoding it to us, then it's all well enough timed to get things going through appropriately.
This sounds like it's going to vary per automation system as to exactly how, whether it's a macro or a cart or whatever it may be that's going to play at just the right time. Maybe, just before the bumper music starts for the show or something like that.
Yeah.
You know what this reminds me of? And I want to hear what David has to say about this in just a minute. But for years, one of the stations that I've owned has been an AM news talk station, and my business partner, it was very persnickety about, well, and he has every right to be, about shows that come in from satellite that either work perfectly or there's a lot of screw ups in them, for starting or stopping a spot break, because they can make you sound pretty bad on the air if your automation doesn't break away or come back at the right time. And a show that always ran super well, and I don't know if he'd like the show or not, but he ran the show because it executed perfectly. And that was the Kim Komando show. And I guess she's still running the show, doing the show. The Kim Komando show, there was not an operator pushing a breakaway button and a rejoin button at just the right times. It was back in the day, it was a 25 hertz tone on a digital cart in their automation system. And so when they hit their break, you'd hear the 25 hertz tone cover. Well, hopefully you wouldn't hear it, but you get the idea. And the last thing in their break, the rejoin, was the 35 hertz tone to come back. I thought, well, how smart is that? Nobody has to think about it. They start the break, the first thing that happens is the tone that fires everything off. And so nowadays we do the same thing, as you said, with a metadata cart that spits metadata out that hose and goes into your stream. David, is this the kind of thing that one of the things that you dealt with in your consulting?
Sure. And I used to deal with that 25 hertz a lot. And it used to be embarrassing if it did get heard, because they'd think the the host made the noise. So that was always embarrassing. But as a matter of fact, one of the things we did when we first created the streams for radio.com back in the day, which was, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we were able to delay the metadata to actually match it, because obviously when you're going through audio processing and you're going through the public internet and everything, there is delay being built. So we were able to delay our metadata so the audio would match, and that was very successful at that point. And we were doing that.
So David,
I want to add that metadata is not new. I mean, television has been doing it for years now.
Right. Yeah.
And radio is just playing catch up. And the new codec being introduced by Fraunhofer, the XHEAAC, that one's going to have metadata built into the standard for it.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I want to hear more about the technicalities on these things. Hopefully Ed will chime in on that. We've got some more topics to talk about, but our show is moving on and it's time to take a quick break. I want you to hear from my friends at Henry Engineering about the Henry Superlight. We'll be right back. Take a look at this box right here. This is the Henry Superlight. Now, you know Henry Engineering, or you should. If you're a broadcast engineer, my goodness, you need to know about Henry Engineering. The Henry Superlight is, it's kind of like the successor to the Henry Super Relay. Maybe you installed a few of those. I certainly have. The Superlight is for running today's low voltage, low wattage LED tally lights. Yeah, that's what it's for. And it's more sophisticated than the Super Relay was. This Henry Superlight, it's a logic and control interface for controlling low voltage studio tally lights. It can directly power 12 volt DC LED tally lights that draw up to half an amp. And it includes a flasher circuit, as well as a double pole, double throw relay output that can be used for any low voltage switching, like speaker muting or other utility use. The LED output can supply 12 volts DC at up to half an amp. It can also sync up to 1 amp if you use it with an external power source. Now, that LED output can be set to flash when on for use with the on-air warning lights, if you like. All control, relay output, and LED output connectors are via plug-in EuroBlock connectors, so they're quick to wire. Now, there are also two RJ45 connectors that are on there. They're provided for control wiring compatibility with the Wheatnet IP Blade and other similar installations that use Cat5, Cat6 wiring. And you can wire this thing up such that it's daisy chained from one unit to another. And you can set the address inside with a little dip jumper, a little header jumper. It's really an awesome little box. You can wire several of these up, like I said, daisy chaining them together if you have a common place for your on-air tally light wiring to go. You need to check this thing out. The Henry Super Light, not the Super Relay, as I wanted to say, because I've been installing so many of those. The Henry Super Light, it's going to help you to get tally lights for your studios and control other things, again, like speaker muting. So you can take one of those inexpensive consoles that doesn't mute the speakers for you. You can light the light and mute the speakers. And hey, if you need to mute the telephone, you could do that too. I think you know how to jump in there and grab that ringer. So check it out, the Henry Super Light and other Henry products at henryeng.com, or you can check out all the products too at Broadcasters General Store. Their website is bgs.cc, but the folks at Broadcasters General Store really just want you to call them. They're great to deal with on the phone. Always somebody's there to answer the phone, listen to what you need, make suggestions if you need suggestions, and they can tell you about delivery to your place with the products that you want. Plus, they got really sharp pencils. Check them out at bgs.cc, but if you want to call them, and I do suggest that, call them at 352-622-7700. That's 352-622-7700 for Broadcasters General Store. And remember, stop by there to get your Henry Super Light. Hey, thanks a lot, BGS, Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. It's episode 560. Can you believe it? Holy cow, I've been doing this 12 years, and we've got some smart people on here talking about streaming. Let's bring them back in. It's Ed Martinez, Robert Minix, and David Bialik, all streaming experts. You know, streaming is something that some stations have been able to take very, very seriously. Others, like myself, you know, I put the gear in, we sign up with a provider, and, you know, we're on. But there can be a lot more to it than that. Ed, we wanted to touch on this idea of rewind, and I don't really know what it is, but maybe it fits in with my desire to, I'm listening to something and I miss what was said. And I just love to go back and hear it. And everybody knows that with streaming, you can't do that. You can't go back, you know, 30 seconds or a minute to hear what you missed. Maybe you went out to the store and you got back in and you hear, oh my gosh, he was talking. Oh, I wanted to hear that. So Ed, tell me about being able to rewind something that we haven't been able to rewind before.
Yeah, most definitely. So when we talk about just the newer workflows in radio, putting, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the show, when we talk about putting the customer and the listener back in the driver's seat on the way that they consume media, that was something that was kind of missing in the industry, where you're listening to a game and you miss what the announcer said at the top of the inning, or like you said, you were busy and distracted with something else and you kind of missed what the sponsorship was or what your local, you know, raffle was for that station. So these days, broadcasters and consumers are like, need and want that technology to be able to rewind a live stream. And, you know, that's one of the techniques that we've really focused on offering as, you know, from a service offering. SJ Rewind is a technology that allows you to take a live linear feed, a traditional live feed, and actually acts as sort of a time machine in order to give you the ability to rewind that stream in real time. So you're able to do that a couple of different ways. You're able to rewind the stream back to, 60 seconds in the past. You can ask, you know, to be rewound all the way to a specific point in time, let's say 9 a.m., in case you missed a specific segment. So it's all about putting kind of the end user and the consumer back in the driver's seat on how they are able to consume that radio stream. These days, it's so important to give people that level of control to say, I missed, you know, the top of the baseball inning. I missed that announcement. Being able to recalibrate that, kind of rewind the tape, so to speak, is something that's really, really important. So SD Rewind is that technology that allows you to take those live linear feeds, rewind them, whether that's to a specific point in the show based on time or to a specific date and time as well. So that's something that's you know, that putting the magic back in radio.
So if I wanted to rewind something, where are the controls for the consumer to go back a little bit?
So there's a couple of different ways it can be accomplished. You know, okay. Traditionally, when you have a desktop-centric app or even a mobile application, you can have different transport controls there on the actual player experience. And that's something that the broadcaster can tailor to say, you know, I want to be able to rewind 60 seconds to the past, or, you know, some broadcasters can offer like a whole timeline of the actual show to be able to point and click back in time. These days, as smart speakers become more prolific in the house and people use them a lot more, you can even have those controls in a voice environment to say, you know, ask your smart speaker to rewind to the top of the hour or to a specific point in time. So in the traditional consumption of a desktop or mobile experience, there's transport controls baked into the player. And then from a voice-centric opportunity, you can build those prompts into the smart speaker experience as well.
Wow. Robert, you interface with customers a lot. What would be a really typical reason that stations would want to make an effort to work with you guys to get to implement Rewind?
Yeah. So I think a while ago I was talking about people that like to archive their shows and make them available, or to do those side channels that I was mentioning for those looping broadcasts. This is a sort of a new way of doing those in a much more short-lived perspective. So maybe you have your news station, you only want to keep the last, you know, few hours worth of it looping because news goes very quickly these days, and you want to be able to jump back to it, but you don't want to necessarily have to archive it, deal with, you know, podcasts or any other sort of way of doing playlisting or anything like that, or having to deal with other live channels. It's all just one stream, could be live, could be rewound, whatever you need it to be, and there's some amount of in the sort of look back that you have access to deal with it. And that's very convenient for a lot of broadcasters. It's also very convenient for a lot of people because it's easy enough to add without necessarily having to do a lot more to add, hey, now we have these podcasts that we're dealing with. Now we have these other streams we have to manage. It's sometimes as simple as us adding the services. The stream can then become rewoundable, and then their player automatically updates because we're the ones that are controlling it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And now their audience went from having only just live stream to having a live stream, and now they can jump back to the show from this morning and listen to it before tomorrow when it automatically gets replaced just by the way that we're doing the DVR with the new show and et cetera. And it's all sort of a little more streamlined and sometimes a little more powerful for clients.
I noticed that you mentioned DVR, and some of your literature also mentions the letters DVR. Are we in fact talking about only audio here, or is more than audio
video? It could be audio. It could be video. It could be audio video if you're the version of video most people want to watch. But yeah, it can work with anything. The most important part of what it is, especially for clients or broadcasters that want to do an implementation themselves, is that the streaming is done via either HLS or MPEG-DASH, and all you have to do is be able to play those formats. You don't have to integrate necessarily with an SDK. You don't have to implement any fancy workflows. All you have to be able to do is play back a stream of that format and know how to tune into the stream appropriately if someone wanted to go back to a particular point in time, and you've got DVR going. And that's pretty straightforward for a lot of clients. And I'm sure David has a lot to say on what that is like from the perspective he got to enjoy, but.
Yeah, and one of the greatest things about this feature, Kirk, is let's say you're not using StreamGuys as your carrier for your stream, your provider for your stream. Mm-hmm. You can stack this on because so when you go into Rewind, you're listening to StreamGuys, but when you're back in normal mode, you're listening to your normal provider. So you don't have to be married for all the services. This is stackable.
David, I want to ask you a question about equipment and software at the station end. You know, this show, This Week in Radio Tech, typically it's broadcast engineers who work at stations that are doing this. A lot of them, you know, we got our hands full. Streaming, okay, yeah, make it easy for me. David, you've been into a lot of radio stations, and I know that you've used a lot of gear from my employer, TELUS Alliance, but talk to us about either the gear or the software that needs to be in place so that you can at least be creating quality streams to send off to your provider, whether that's StreamGuys or somebody else. What do stations really need to think about sticking in the rack or into a computer?
Well, I used to always tell everyone, if you say three words, then you got a problem. And if you say it's just the stream, that means they're not caring, because this is a way of disseminating your content, and it should be just as important as your transmitter. And streaming and over the air, we have different parameters. As you know, I work with loudness and so forth, and there are different loudness scales for over the air and for streams, but I'm not even going to get into that. But you should have a good encoder. I can't tell you how many times I was working at major broadcasters and I said, okay, where's the stream encoder? And they said, oh yeah, that's the secretary's old computer. No. Remember, you wouldn't use that for your transmitter. Why are you using an old computer for your stream? You need to dedicate your stream to good equipment, whether it's a encoder that your company or other companies make, or it's a computer. You need to make sure it's in good condition, and you want to make sure that it's a quality device, because this is your transmitter. And let's face it, streaming is the transmitter of the future. In the past pandemic, we have seen that in-home listening has gone incredibly high. The total listener hours on the smart speaker and everything has amazed everybody with the growth of the listener. So remember that you don't have a tabletop radio in your house anymore, but yeah, you might have a smart speaker or two. And are you telling that device to listen to the radio? And guess what? You're not listening to the radio. You're listening to the stream. And that's why, so to the listener, the stream has already become synonymous. Now the broadcaster has to realize that and care about the stream just as much.
One thing that I've noticed is that some of the all music streaming services like Spotify and Pandora and others, they're pretty consistent with quality and loudness. I'm typically listening on a small speaker, so they're not on a big speaker. What do broadcasters need to make sure they're doing? So they're, yeah, I guess it's almost like it's ours to lose, or it's ours to regain in terms of the whole streaming realm. At my house, sometimes I'm listening to one of my own radio stations out in the hallway. I'm always listening to our Hawaii radio station because I love the music selection there. What do broadcasters need to make sure they're doing so that they're not obviously eclipsed quality-wise by these other streaming services?
You're making a good point, and something I've been spending a good portion of the last 3 years doing. For video, video streaming, which is called OTT, over the top, they have it pretty much solved. For audio only, we're only touching it. Don't you hate when you listen to those streams, you're listening to a favorite radio station, the commercial comes on and it's 6-7 dB louder than the content and so forth. Yeah. And then there might even be inconsistencies of the ads being played, because on a lot of the streams nowadays, the streams are coming in from different networks from all over the world because they're being called up by metadata, which you covered before. And you find out that the levels are all different. And guess what? If you're going to touch, if you have to ask the listener to touch their volume knob because you're blasting them, remember the old Maxell ad where the guy would sit in the chair and be listening and have the glass blown out of his hand. Guess what? That's what's happening. And if you're encouraging the listener to touch your volume knob, you're encouraging them to turn you off or turn something else on.
David,
and the David. Audio engine. Yes, that's the ad. The Audio Engineering Society has been working very hard on loudness recommendations. Mm-hmm. And Robert's nodding because he sat in quite a few of the meetings. And for the last few years, we've had Technical Document 104. That has been a recommendation for loudness. And guess what? Not many people have been following it. So we went back and said, okay, how can we make this better? Because television has standardized their loudness at a minus 24 LKFS. Mm-hmm. And audio only, we're standardizing at a minus 17 for radio style streams. Hmm. So, we are louder than television, louder than video, excuse me. The new recommendation, and this is the first time it's being announced, Kirk, which will be Technical Document 108. It's due to be released sometime very soon, probably within the next month, because the document's been written. It's now going through all the administrative details, and I will make sure that you get a copy of that. It will tell you how to make sure the loudness is standardized.
David, so I'm guessing that my old method of making sure that inserted commercials were never louder than my station was by me just cranking my stream processing up really, really loud. That's not really the way we want to do it anymore, is it?
Well, here's what I did when I was at Entercom.
Uh-huh.
I had all the commercials normalized at a minus 18 LKFS.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And remember that when we're talking LKFS in the digital realm, the higher the number, it's really lower. And then I was normalizing, I was setting my processing for my music and my host and so forth to be at minus 17. And that's how we accomplished a very consistent sound.
Yeah.
And it worked. And if you encourage that, you're not going to have the disparity of the levels. You're not going to encourage the listener to turn you off or turn you on, and thus you're going to get a higher TLH, and your TLH is your total listener hour.
Total listener hours.
That's what your management cares about.
Hey, unfortunately, we're going to run out of time. This man, there's so many subjects to talk about, and we could have spent an hour on any one of them. But before we take our next break, we've got to cover this idea of controlled access. So I've got a friend who owns a radio station here in Nashville. Honestly, I don't know if he's connected with Stream Guys or not, but he's offering his regular stream for free, or you can pay him a couple bucks a month and you don't hear any commercials, or you hear fewer commercials or something, and you get a higher bit rate on the stream. That sounds a bit like a feature that Stream Guys is offering. Who wants to take that question on or explain how that works?
I could take that question, Kirk.
Sure. Thanks for that. Go ahead, Ed.
So when we talk about content control and content access, you know, being able to provide that gate and segment your content and have a secure way of offering that to the public becomes very important to the broadcaster. There's a number of different ways to accomplish that. One of the main themes that we've kind of seen and that's become more popular in the industry recently has been the tokenization of the stream. When we talk about tokenization, we talk about a URL that's traditionally unique to the end listener. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique URL that gets signed. You can have an encrypted token, or you can have a signed URL. And by that, we mean it's a URL that's unique to the end listener. Sometimes that could be have the addition of having things like, you know, the unique signed URL might be locked down to a specific IP address. But most times it also has just an expiry window built in. So as a broadcaster, when a listener tunes in, you could say this link is valid for a week. And after that week, when they go to tune in again, they could get redirected to a different stream or a different page. But it really allows the segmentation of and content access to be gated by the actual broadcaster and have that level of granularity and control. The way that you alluded to that, people use it, you know, in a couple of different scenarios. We can start at kind of the granular level to say you can implement things like geo restrictions for the stream to say only have the content be accessible within the US. But at a more granular level, we see broadcasters implementing the stream protection to do things like offering premium content. You know, the concept of a pledge drive or a pledge-free stream where you don't have any advertisements is certainly becoming a lot more popular. And in some cases, we'll see broadcasters, you know, have a premium offering about, you know, more experimental features that might have things like higher quality streaming. You see a lot of broadcasters playing around with, you know, quote-unquote uncompressed streaming or extra high-quality streaming in 1.5 megabit streams, whether that's FLAC or MQA, things like that. You know, those type of things you want to keep within a premium experience. So tokenization is certainly the theme that we see there in terms of content protection. At StreamGuys, we accomplish it with our SG Passkey product. You know, that's one implementation of content protection and stream protection. But at the end of the day, it's a way to gate that content and only allow, you know, people that you sure are authorized to listen to that content in that type of environment. In other cases, you know, you can see it being used for providing segmented access to streams to specific affiliates, where you can offer that broadcast for a specific amount of time, and then that link will expire. You know, if you have a certain fixed date there or an agreement with that affiliate to stop receiving that stream with an authorized feed after a certain period of time.
So when you say affiliate, so as in, I guess you might call it kind of a backhaul situation.
Indeed. Yeah. So when we talk about an affiliate, it's a way to distribute protected streams, to different affiliates in that case. So it can be used for backhaul. It is, you know, really popular for that too, because at the end of the day, you're segmenting that and making sure that only the authorized, you know, parties have access to that content. It could be from the consumer side, you know, when you're tuning into it, or it could be on the backhaul side as well. Correct.
Do you see traditional terrestrial broadcasters who are also streaming on the web? What are some business arguments for doing this? I'm thinking maybe you love the morning show and you want to hear the backstage that happens after 9 a.m. after the later morning person takes over, or maybe you want to sell conditional access to your woohoo in Texas, your Friday night high school football, and make a couple dollars on that, or hear a no commercial version of the Friday night football. What are some applications for this that I didn't mention already?
All the examples that you mentioned are great, but at the end of the day, yeah, it's conditional access to either a high quality stream, mm-hmm. you know, no ads, specially produced content or streams that might not even be publicly listed for something like only, you know, a members only type situation or a paid subscriber type situation there. All those things where you need conditional access to a stream, that's where you would implement tokenization. And the beauty about that is it is all, you know, it's very standards based. You know, the sense of security from the technology side there, at the end of the day, you're creating something that's unique as a signed URL. So it's still part of the traditional stream protocols that you'd have and you're used to. It's just a protected link that can't be shared with other people.
Gotcha. Okay. You know, gosh, yes, go ahead.
One way this can be used really well is if, let's say, a corporation has having a meeting and it's only for employees only. Mm-hmm. This way they can make sure only the employees are listening to it.
So it doesn't have to be monetized. It could be, is for a specific audience and no one else needs to see or hear this.
Yeah.
Correct.
One of the most common ways we even see it is just to make sure that only that client's website or that client's app can listen to the stream.
Yeah.
And that can help avoid, you know, robots, people stealing their streams, all that kind of stuff that has actually been a lot of a problem in the past couple of years, is that people want to stream too and they don't want to make their own content. So it's been pretty important.
So tell you what, we've got to take a break in a minute. I want to hold off that break for just a second. We got to talk for a minute about HLS. A few years ago when HLS started becoming available to broadcasters and when my employer, Telus Alliance, put HLS encoding into some of our products, I did some videos on how HLS works. So I don't want to necessarily cover how HLS works in this show, but you know, since I did those videos and my employer Telos, we sell some products that can do HLS, which HTTP live streaming, which lets the player, the client at the other end, decide, am I going to listen to a high speed stream, medium, low? You got several different choices in there. It always provides you the best quality stream that your bandwidth will allow. That's the bottom line. But, you know, I just haven't seen too many people doing this yet. You guys may be quite the exception. Tell me about how HLS is picking up, or do we even know that? I mean, if I'm using some player from some radio station, I may not even know I'm getting HLS automatically selecting my bitrate for me. Talk to me about where that stands in terms of rollout and adoption at this point.
Yeah, most definitely. So we do see HLS growing as a delivery protocol. The beauty of HLS, that, you know, that being as a standard, you might not even know that you're using it on the consumption side of it, but it is something that brings so many benefits to the consumer from a battery perspective. And we don't want to jump too much into those details, but from a battery perspective, the ability to have a dynamic quality range to where you can transition a lot easier on a mobile device between cell towers and have that resiliency and have that stream, you know, still be there rock solid from a playback perspective, are reasons why we're seeing it become a lot more popular for a lot of different broadcasters. If you're not able to send a direct HLS streams to us, you know, there's different methodologies where a broadcaster could send us a single feed and we can actually use, you know, what we call transmuxing to change that protocol and provide an HLS stream,
right?
You know, for that station.
Right. So, okay. All right. I talked up this technology a lot a few years ago at NAB shows and SBE meetings and things like that. And I haven't seen much adoption, but also I may not be aware of automatic adoption. And by the way, folks, if you know, this multi-rate streaming with automatic selection, every time you turn on, I don't know, I'm just going to use Netflix as an example. I watch cartoons with my kids. We turn on Netflix and for the first 10 seconds, the cartoon's a little fuzzy. And I'm thinking, something wrong with the bit right here. What's the deal? And then in 10 seconds, boop, it just clears. It's as perfect as could be. Well, they wanted to deliver my movie as bam, as quick as possible with the smallest file size to download. But then as soon as the player figured out, oh man, 10 seconds of video just got downloaded in 0.25 seconds. I think dude's got some bandwidth here. Let's feed him the high quality version. Is that basically what HLS streaming is?
Yeah.
That's one of the features of HLS in terms of being able to provide adaptive bitrate streaming. It is kind of one of the facets, and we do see it becoming more and more used in the industry. But just like you did for Netflix, it can be applicable for audio-only streams as well.
And can something like your passkey technology be applied with HLS streams?
Indeed, yeah. Okay. So tokenization for the variety of streaming protocols that we support, both HLS and Dash, as well as traditional HTTP streaming, can be tokenized and protected as well.
All right, as usual, I've done a terrible job of preparing my guests for the very last segment of the show. So I'm going to prepare you right now before our commercial break. The most valuable part of the show is coming up, and that's right after, yes, the crass commercial messages. No, they're not crass at all. Well, I'm doing them. So right after this break, Ed and David and Robert are each going to have a tip of the week for you, something quick and important that, you know, whether it's a website, a tool, something you need to read, something you need to watch, something you need to be aware of. They're each going to have a tip for you coming up in just a minute, and it's going to be the best part of the show, I promise you. And now, you know, no pressure, guys. That's coming up in just a minute. This week in Radio Tech, we are watching episode number 560 with Ed Martinez and Robert Minix and David Bialik. Ed and Robert are both from Stream Guys, and David is a consultant to the broadcast industry at large and to Stream Guys, making streaming better for consumers everywhere. We're going to be right back after this. Hang on. As broadcast engineers, we spend a lot of our time connecting things together, but sometimes it's just as important to be able to disconnect something. What am I talking about? This is the Angry Audio Disconnector. The disconnector. So here you have something that you just put in series with your headphones, with your Talence headphones. Now, this is available in the quarter-inch tip ring sleeve size, as you see here. Also available in the 3.5 millimeter size. And you can even mix and match inputs and outputs. The point is, this is what's in the middle. This is the disconnector. So you have a talent that forgets to take their headphones off. They get up, they start to walk away, and boop, look at that. no more damage to the connectors that you normally use, no more damage to the headphone jack on the audio console or under the furniture. Oh, look, it just went back together, and I wasn't even trying. It's magnetic. It's the disconnector, or the headphone disconnector, from Angry Audio. Disconnector. Ah. No more broken connectors. Check it out on the web at angryaudio.com.
With all of the recent cybersecurity attacks against large corporations, we were looking for a product that would give us the ultimate in security at our transmitter sites and as well as with our broadcast equipment. MaxConnect fits the bill very well. Its greatest security feature is the fact that it gives you a single static IP address. Using this single static IP address allows us to close hundreds of open ports on our firewalls across the company and restrict access to only the MaxConnect IPs. This has greatly reduced our exposure to the World Wide Web and made us much more secure moving forward. It's also given us the ability to expand as needed in a secure fashion.
MaxConnect Wireless, it works when your phone doesn't. It really does. As far as data is concerned, it'll get you on that on the data channel on the nearest cell tower and get you going, get you on the air. We've used it here at This Week in Radio Tech, and we've also used it at the SBE. And let me tell you, literally hundreds of broadcasters are using MaxConnect Wireless now to do real remote broadcasts and as a backup for their transmitter site. It works great for getting audio to the transmitter site if things are down otherwise, like the tornado that hit my STL tower. Check them out, MaxConnectWireless.com. Thanks a lot for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, it's This Week in Radio Tech, our 560th episode. Kirk Harnack here in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Oh, real quick, I want to mention something. Radio Guide magazine, a great partner with This Week in Radio Tech. Radio Guide is a technical magazine for radio broadcasters. And one of the things I like about it is that the articles are longer. They're more in-depth. So if you go to radio-guide.com, radio-guide.com, you can read previous issues of Radio Guide magazine. You can sign up to have it delivered to your home. So check it out at radio-guide.com. All right, let us get me off the screen, full screen, get back with Ed, Robert, and David. Ed and Robert are with Stream Guys. David is a consultant to Stream Guys and to the rest of us. He's put a lot of streams on the web. He's the one taking up all that bandwidth. That's David Bialik. Well, I guess. Hey, Stream Guys, Ed or Robert, how many terabytes of data a day come out of your servers? That's got to be a ton. You ever keep track of that?
Oh, it's a ton. That number changes so rapidly on a daily basis. I'd have to find the that specific daily update chart to pull that out. But it's certainly a lot.
I'll tell you what. Two of my radio stations are in American Samoa. Come to think of it, we got three stations there. Three stations are in American Samoa, and the time that our stream gets clobbered is when the Polynesians are playing football. All the Samoans on the west coast of the U.S. and in Hawaii are tuned in to the games going on in Tafuna on the main island of American Samoa. Mm-hmm. Okay, hey, we got tip of the week, and this is what you held over for. Ed Martinez, what you got for us for a tip of the week?
Well, Kirk, thanks for that wonderful transition. It actually ties into what you just talked about.
Uh-oh.
My tip of the week is to actually check out SRT, that stands for Secure Reliable Transport, and it's a purpose-built protocol in order to increase the resiliency of your broadcast transmissions over the public internet. So as you mentioned, when people are using the internet or you're on a local network there that might not be that great, where you might suffer from packet loss or jitter, you can use SRT to get a stream reliably, whether that's to your CDN or whether that's backhaul to another transmitter site. Check out SRT for a secure, reliable transport as a mechanism to improve your reliability of transmitting streams over the internet.
I will find a couple of articles about that. And Ed, if you have something you think is particularly good to educate about SRT technology, let me know and I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Awesome. Cool. All right, Robert, you're next. You're in the hot seat. What words of wisdom do you have for our audience, Robert?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I would be bereft if I did not mention the importance of monitoring for your streams.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, monitoring.
Would you like to know if your stream is online or offline? Would you like to know if it's actually containing content or if it's just silent dead air. I think it's very important these days as people move into streaming. They're very used to having silent sensors in the studio. They're very used to having sort of hardware level monitoring of what they're doing. But once you get into streaming land, once you've got that signal out the door and you're sending it off to the CDN, to us or to anyone else, sometimes things can go wrong in the encoder. Sometimes things can go wrong down chain, and you don't necessarily know if you're not paying attention constantly to your stream. So monitoring is important. Make sure you find someone that can help you with monitoring, whether that's your provider directly or a third party. But I think it's important people do that these days.
It is. You know what? I stream so our stations happen to be with a different provider at the moment. We're going to have a meeting about that in the next week or two. But yeah, I get a text when a stream is down, and I know, oh, American Samoa just ran out of satellites, you know, for their internet, or must be a power outage in Greenville, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. It's always comforting to see it came back up. Hey, five mm-hmm. stations came back up. Good. Okay, I can go back to sleep now. Monitoring. Yep. And is monitoring typically an extra add-on expense for CDNs or what?
It depends. I think it certainly is for us just because it's a value add for what people are doing. But I think it generally is. Depends on the provider.
Good deal. All right. We're going to leave it now to David Bialik for some words of wisdom. Take it away, David Bialik.
Well, first off, I want to reiterate what Robert just said. Mm-hmm. You got to monitor your streams and you got to care about them, because caring about the stream is caring about your content. And that's the engineer's job. And I also want to leave you with this words of wisdom. Mm-hmm. We all remember the show WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It was a documentary. It wasn't a fiction.
It's a documentary. Yes. Yes. I think you're right. It was. How many of us know people in radio who are just like the characters?
Every single one of the characters.
Every single one of the characters. Absolutely. That's why it resonated so well, at least with broadcasters. But it seemed to resonate well with non-broadcasters too, didn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. What was the engineer's name? Bucky?
Bucky.
Bucky who? Bucky Dornster?
Yes, Bucky Dornster.
Oh my gosh.
I think he only showed up at one episode because there was something, but
he was doing, if you remember, the best
line ever was said, and I'm not going to say the turkey one. I'm going to say when Cincinnati was being hit by a blizzard and was knocked off the air, and it came in and say, "Hey, Les, we're off the air." And he goes, "I know. That's my first lead. That's my lead story."
Oh my gosh. Oh guys, we could go on and on. I appreciate so much the technology talk. If you want to know more about the things we talked about, certainly Stream Guys is a major player in the whole streaming world. I've known about Stream Guys. How long has Stream Guys been around?
We've been around since 2000.
2000. Okay. That's easy to count from. So coming up on your 21st anniversary, right? Or you're there.
Yep. Next month, actually.
Next month. Yep. Good deal. Good deal. Awesome. Awesome. Well, Ed Martinez, thank you for joining us. Robert Minix, thank you for joining us. David Bialik, thank you for joining us as well. I want to give a big thanks to our producer, Suncast, for producing the show, taking care of the lower thirds, publishing and all that. And thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the owner of the GFQ Network, Guys from Queens Network, where you'll find some other fine podcasts as well. Check it all out at gfqnetwork.com. All right, join us next week. We're going to have more fun, and maybe we'll have no way we could find guests as good as these. We're going to do it all next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.